Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Naugh, and this is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, we're going to examine the area of psychiatry, the failures and crimes of big psychiatry. My guest later in the program would be Dr. Gary Coles. Dr. Coles is a retired family practitioner specializing in preventative mental health care. He's been doing that for most of his career. We're going to begin today, however, with Robert Whittaker. Robert Whittaker is a journalist covering medicine and science. He's received numerous awards, including the George Polk Award and the National Association of Science Writers Award. Earlier, Robert was a director of publications at Harvard Medical School and was a co-founder of CenterWatch, a publishing house covering clinical trials in the pharmaceutical industry. For the past dozen years, Robert has been writing on the psychiatric industry. He's written bestsellers such as Anatomy of an Epidemic, which takes a hard look at the damage caused by psychiatric drugs, and received the Investigative Reporter and Editor's Award for Best Investigative Journalism. And more recently, Psychiatry Under the Influence, Institutional Corruption, and Prescriptions for Reform. He is at a conference in Denmark that is sponsored by Dr. Peter Gochi. Now, Dr. Gochi is at the Nordic Cochrane Center in Denmark, and he estimates that over 500,000 people over the age of 65 die every year from psychiatric drugs. He has been a major opponent of the medical establishment that tries to justify this loss by continuing to prescribe these drugs for profit. But let's pull back for a moment and look at the larger issue. The psychiatric industry is now a $330 billion a year industry. Worldwide, over 100 million people are prescribed psychiatric drugs. Worldwide, 17 million children take psychiatric drugs, 10 million of those in the United States. 10% of all teenagers in the United States now take Ritalin or Adderall. Children under 5 years of age are now the fastest growing group being prescribed antidepressants, and over 200,000 under the age of 6 months. Antidepressants account for 25,000 emergency room visits per year, and antipsychotics for 22,000, meaning over 50% of all drug adverse reactions related to emergency care are psychiatric drugs. The sedative Ambien has resulted in over 100,000 emergency visits alone. The Cochrane's review of these drugs show that almost all clinical trials carried out by drug corporations are biased, and that in almost all cases the patients used the trials were on the other medications first. They stop these earlier drugs, undergo serious withdrawal symptoms, and then start the new drug, and the companies then claim success. According to the Cochrane Group of Individual Scientists Independent of Industry, deaths from suicide during clinical trials are dramatically underreported. There are now 22 international drug regulatory warnings about psychiatric drugs referencing causes for violent behavior, mania, psychoses, homicidal ideation, and 49 warnings as the cause for suicidal ideation. Between 2005 and 2011, psychoactive drug use in the military rose 700%. It was 1,083% for antipsychotic drugs. According to the most recent U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, 23 soldiers and vets commit suicide every 24 hours, largely due to antidepressant use. Researchers discovered that 25 psychiatric drugs are now associated with physical assault and homicide. The medical literature has many references to sudden death being associated with antipsychotic medications. Neurologist Fred Bauman researched soldier and veteran's sudden cardiac deaths and found the large majority were caused by antipsychotic prescription drugs. 70% of all psychotropic drugs are being prescribed by general physicians. That means that over two-thirds of people on these drugs have not had a professional psychiatric evaluation to even know whether a prescription is warranted. There seems to be strong evidence that antidepressants are no better than placebos or sugar pills. In fact, one very important study showed that regular daily exercise was as, if not better, than psychiatric medication. In fact, from an important meta-analysis performed at Harvard of controlled drug trials in 1998, Harvard again performed a larger meta-analysis in 2008 and came to the same conclusion that placebos, sugar pills, are just as effective. So let's put this in perspective. Today we have a psychiatric industry that is now one of the most profitable parts of the medical industrial complex. We have seen the increase in people being diagnosed with supposed brain chemical imbalances and then given prescription medication, either antipsychotic or antidepressant medication, as the primary treatment of choice. We now have an effort to give mental health screening tests to children to see if they would qualify as being labeled mentally disabled and hence being forced to take psychiatric medication. We have 98% of all mass killings in the last 30 years from individuals who were on psychiatric medication, and yet, mainly by the liberal left and the corporate left, they want to blame guns and never once take a look at psychiatric medications that these killers were on. We now have more vets complaining about the effects of the drugs they're on than ever before in American history, and yet there is no effort to prevent them from getting on the drugs when they're in battlefield operations like Afghanistan or Iraq. And then when they get home, there's no effective way of providing them with any form of holistic psychotherapy or any form of humanistic psychology. Instead, it's drugs. I've interviewed over 1,100 of these vets, and their life is not positive. When we were growing up, those of us who are baby boomers, you did not have childhood suicide. Now it's the number one cause of death in 10 to 14-year-old boys. We did not have kids that were diagnosed as having ADD or ADHD, and yet we had the same type of kids. Some were bored, others were extremely assertive, some were very curious. But today, that is all considered a very commercial and viable way of commodifying an entire generation of children. So it's completely normal now to hear kids taking psychiatric drugs. So it's a big problem. Today we're only going to take a look at one piece of the puzzle, and that is a very meticulous, probably the first time ever, this definitive research into do the drugs work. We're not going to challenge the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Psychiatry, number 2345. We're not going to diagnose the over-medicating of people. We're only looking at, do they work? Robert Whitaker is the speaker and the researcher.
In 1955, a drug called, in the United States, chlorpromazine, I think you called it Largactil here in Denmark, it arrives in asylum medicine, and it is said to kick off a great psychopharmacological revolution, a great advance in care. Our understanding is it was this drug that made it possible to empty the state, the mental hospitals. We remember this drug as the first antipsychotic, and if you hear those words, antipsychotic, as it's almost like as if it's an antibiotic, a specific antidote to psychosis. Then we get antidepressants, we get anti-anxiety agents, again, each time anti-something or other, as if they're specific antidotes. And then if we go forward in this story of progress, in 1987, we get Prozac. It's the first of the second generation psychiatric drugs. which are said to be safer and more effective than the first. So this is this rise up this medical ladder of progress. Then we get new atypical antipsychotics. And again, and so for example, in 1998, the U.S. Surgeon General in the United States named David Satcher, so this is our top doctor in the United States, he issued like a 500-page report on mental health, and here's what he said. Prior to the arrival of chlorpromazine in asylum medicine, we lacked treatments that would prevent people from becoming chronically ill. People used to just stay in the mental hospitals. Now we have a vast array of safe and effective treatments for well-defined disorders that help people live more normal lives, function well. So that's the story of progress, okay? And certainly it's the story of progress that when I was a newspaper writer writing about psychiatric issues, I believed in. And at least in the United States, we used to hear this metaphor. The drugs were like insulin for diabetes. Did you ever hear that in Denmark? Well, if that's so, there are few, that's a story of extraordinary progress. Because that's a story where you've uncovered the pathology of a disorder, and now you have a drug that fixes that pathology. And if you look in the history of medicine, of great advances, that's a model for a great advance in medical care. And insulin for diabetes is a perfect example of a great advance in medical care, right? You identify the pathology, and now you have a remedy for that. So that's the context, and I think it's that story actually in large measure that drives our use of these medications. And in the last 20 years, there's been a worldwide surge in the use of the medications led by the United States. In 1987, when Prozac came to market, we spent about $800 million on psychiatric drugs. And by 2010, anybody have a guess about what we were spending in the United States on psychiatric drugs? Any guess? $40 billion. So a 50-fold increase. And one of the things in the United States we kept hearing is that these disorders are under-recognized and under-treated. So many more people are getting treatment. So hopefully as more people are getting treatment, but theoretically if these drugs are so effective, we should hopefully see the burden of mental illness in our society go down. Does that make sense? But that's sort of the expectation. And that's really the story I tell in Anatomy of an Epidemic. There's this common story, but is science telling us a different story, a more complex story? Because in the United States, you take one glance around and the burden of mental illness is not decreasing. It's rising dramatically. So that's the beginning point of saying what's going on. So one of the first things I wanted to do was just trace the discovery of these medications. How did it come about? Now, often when you think about great advances in medical care, you start with looking at the people with, quote, the disease. You identify the pathology, and then after that identification has happened, you develop a drug. That's not how psychiatric medications came about. Psychiatric medications actually came about by research looking for magic bullets, basically for infectious illnesses. And what's a magic bullet? A magic bullet in medical literature is a drug that will be a toxin to like a bacteria. It will kill that bacteria without interacting with tissues of the human body, and that's what makes it a magic bullet. It's just toxic to the invader, but not to the individual. And penicillin obviously is an example of a magic bullet. So start with antipsychotics. Where did they arise from? Well, they actually arose, if you go far enough back, into research for magic bullets against worm-borne illnesses. So they were running through different compounds to see if they could find something that would kill worm-borne illnesses without causing great damage to the body. And as they're doing this, they found a group of compounds that maybe seemed to have some merit in that regard. But as they tested those compounds, as they used them, they noticed a couple things, that they had a side effect in humans that might seem useful initially in surgery. And actually what the first compound did is, there was a problem with surgery with surgical shock when you cut someone open, and this new drug had antihistaminergic properties, so basically prevented this response of this body to this wound in essence. So they now begin developing this. It's French surgeons begin developing this. And as they use it in surgery, they also begin to notice this. It induces a great emotional sort of tranquility, or people can't make an emotional response to the world. They talk about their patients being separated from the world as if by a glass wall. So what they realize is this compound seems to prevent sort of an emotional response to the world. And one of the things they notice, but it does it even while not making a person, so sedated they lose consciousness. So you could retain consciousness, but not mount much of an emotional response to the world. So the surgeons notice this. At some point they present at a conference, and psychiatrists say, oh, this is very much like a surgical lobotomy. It's causing a change in being, very much akin to what we see when we do an operation where we, in essence, sever the frontal lobes. Now, today we might think that's an odd thing to compare it to a surgical lobotomy, because today we remember surgical lobotomy as a mutilating surgery. But it wasn't in 1955. In 1949, the inventor of surgical lobotomy, a Portuguese neurologist named Egas Moniz, won the Nobel Prize in Medicine for having invented surgical lobotomy. So it was seen as a miracle brain surgery. And what surgical lobotomy did is it did cause with great regularity a change in being where someone was less engaged, and that was seen as a good thing. That was the value. And these drugs were seen as the new ones, the chlorpromazine and all, were seen as causing a change in being similar to what surgical lobotomy did. And now if you go into the science of it, there's a reason for this. So frontal lobotomy, of course, is the frontal lobes, is that front part of our brain. So if you look at how chlorpromazine or Largactil works, it basically blocks the passage of messages along what are called dopaminergic pathways. And one of the dopaminergic pathways goes to the frontal lobes. So in essence, you are diminishing activity in the same part of the brain that surgical lobotomy did. So you can see the kinship. Anyway, when those drugs first came out, they were likened to chemical lobotomy. So I'm talking about the first, chlorpromazine. They were also called major tranquilizers. And does that word translate well, tranquilizers? It wasn't seen as an antipsychotic, and we'll get in a little bit to how they start being seen as antipsychotic. But that's where antipsychotics came from. Out of research into surgery, the drugs that they saw prevented a normal sort of emotional response to the world, and because of that they saw that it would be helpful in asylum medicine. So that's the historical context for that. The next group of drugs we get are actually the anti-anxiety agents we now remember as anti-anxiety agents, and they arose from research into gram-negative bacteria. So you have gram-positive bacteria, and penicillin and other antibiotics are very effective against gram-positive bacteria, but there's another very common type of bacteria called gram-negative that penicillin is not effective for, so they were looking for magic bullets against this other type of bacteria. And they began using, testing different medications, and they came upon a group initially, this is actually for something called meprobate, that when they gave it to rats, they found that rats just didn't care. By that I mean is normally if you put a rat, for example, on an electrified floor, they'll become very aggressive. These rats didn't care. And once again, they didn't sort of mount any sort of emotional response to the world. They became much less aggressive. And this begins research into agents that eventually become the anti-anxiety agents. Because think about this. The rats aren't care. They're not getting anxious. Their heartbeat is not increasing in times of peril, which is a sign of your usual emotional response. So they're saying, see, if you have people who are too anxious, they mount too much of an emotional response to the world, we can now have an agent that dims that response. And one of my favorite advertisements is when you see these drugs, and they're called the happy pills, when they're introduced in the United States. One of my favorite advertisements goes like this, or one of my favorite stories about these drugs. The scientists talk about this. If you see a car coming, about to hit you, you may still try to run, but you won't be afraid anymore. Something to that effect. And the point is, you just won't mount your usual emotional response. And at the same time, they were called happy pills. At sometimes they were also called don't give a damn pills. Okay, so that was the two things. Now, the antidepressants came out of research into anti-tuberculosis drugs. The agents they're using are actually agents that were fuels in sort of synthesized by Nazis, German scientists, during World War II as a type of fuel when their regular fuels ran out. So they get these type of fuels, and after the war, the Allies say, well, let's see if any of these novel compounds have magic bullet properties. They find a couple that seem to be maybe effective against tuberculosis. They give them to TB patients, and they note, at least this is how Time magazine reported it, that the TB patients, and think about TB, you have lung problems, you're very lethargic. Supposedly the TB patients became roused. So they said, see, this is a drug that causes arousal, so maybe we can lift depressed patients, okay? The point of this story is this. All these agents were not discovered, this first generation, out of an understanding of what was going on in the brains of people with schizophrenia, depression, or anxiety. They were all brought into psychiatry because they had, in essence, adverse effects that were seen as helpful for psychiatric patients. So the antipsychotics basically quieted person, tranquilized them, made them less responsive. The anti-anxiety agents, very similar. And the antidepressants seem to be arousal agents. But they're brought into psychiatry because of these adverse effects. This now is going to get transformed into the chemical imbalance theory of mental disorders. So how do we move from adverse effects into this theory? Because now once we get to a chemical imbalance theory, that means they are fixing a pathology. And this story arises in this way. What happens in the 1960s is they start to understand how the drugs act on the brain, okay? We're not going to get into the pathology of people yet, but it's how the drugs act on the brain. So how do neurons communicate in the brain? And by the way, this was just being learned in the 60s, okay? It's not like we knew this before. So you have one neuron, which we call the presynaptic neuron. This is how neurons communicate in the brain. That presynaptic neuron was found to release a small molecule, which we call a neurotransmitter or a chemical messenger, and that molecule binds with receptors on the second neuron, and we say it fits into those receptors like a key into a lock. Do you use that metaphor here as well? And when that happens, neuron number one releases a chemical which binds with receptors on the second neuron. That's the way a message is passed. And when that message is passed, one of two things will happen. It can excite the second neuron, cause it to fire, or there are also ones that are inhibitory, make it harder to fire, okay? One final thing, sorry. Let's go back to how neurons communicate. You have a presynaptic neuron, releases that messenger, say dopamine, into that tiny gap. It binds with receptors. Now, the brain has to have a way to curb that message, okay, to end that message. So it has to remove that chemical, that dopamine, from that tiny gap, okay? It has to remove it. And it removes it in one of two ways. It either goes back up into the presynaptic neuron via reuptake channels, or an enzyme comes along, metabolizes as it breaks down the dopamine into metabolites, and those metabolites are carted off as waste. Okay, does that make sense? So what do the first generation antipsychotics do? Chlorpromazine, Haldol, what do you call Haldol? Okay, so there's a group of these first generation, and they're actually initially named neuroleptics. Does that word, a neuroleptic is something that takes hold of the nervous system. That's actually their first name. So what they found is, eventually, is that these drugs block 70% of the receptors for dopamine, and actually a very particular type of the receptor called the D2 receptor. So at a therapeutic dose, what's happening is this. That molecule, the drug, is fitting into the receptor on the postsynaptic neuron, but it's blocking it. It's like pouring glue into the lock, all right? It's not activating it. It's just blocking it. And so since it's on there, now the neurotransmitter has no lock to go to, okay? So because it's blocking it, okay, researchers hypothesized maybe people with schizophrenia have too much dopamine, okay? So that's where that arises. Understanding of the drug, and then we're going to posit that the opposite is the cause of schizophrenia, okay? Now, how about antidepressants? Antidepressants were similar. The first type of antidepressants, one were tricyclic antidepressants, the other were known as monoamine oxidase inhibitors, and they both kept a serotonin, a different chemical messenger, in that synaptic cleft longer than normal, although by different means. So what did tricyclics do? Tricyclics prevented the reuptake of serotonin from that synaptic cleft, and so serotonin now stays longer in that gap. It's upping serotonergic activity. A drug we call a monoamine oxidase inhibitor, what it does is it inhibits the enzyme that breaks down serotonin, and because of that, once again, serotonin stays longer in the synaptic cleft. So researchers hypothesized again antidepressants, and depression is due to low serotonin, which is then fixed by these drugs that increase it. So these things get, there's a little bit of other evidence, but this is the basic evidence for the chemical imbalance theory of mental disorders. They arise in the late 60s. Now in the 1970s, we're going to begin to investigate them. How are we going to investigate them? Well, researchers actually came out initially with a very sort of novel way to try to see about the levels of these neurotransmitters in the brain. And here's what they said. Let's start with this a high dopamine theory of depression, schizophrenia. An enzyme comes along, metabolizes the dopamine, right? Those metabolites are carted off as waste, and they're going to show up in the cerebrospinal fluid. So researchers said this. If people with schizophrenia have too much dopamine activity, they should have extra high levels of dopamine metabolites in their cerebrospinal fluid. Does that make sense? It's an indirect measure of it. So you go back to it's like late 70s, and the researchers announce, we have found the cause of schizophrenia. In fact, schizophrenia patients have too many dopamine metabolites in their cerebrospinal fluid. New York Times reports, looks like the cause of schizophrenia has been found. But then you have to read the paper. Because the researchers said, we don't know if this is due to the disease or the drug. Is it a response to the drug? And so now, next what they do is they do it in unmedicated patients who have never been medicated. And once they do that, they do not find that the metabolite levels are abnormally high in schizophrenia patients. So what are they seeing? They're seeing, in essence, this. Well, this is the second part, but we'll get to this in a second. So the brain, being this extraordinarily neuroplastic organ, has all these feedback mechanisms. You go on a drug, an antipsychotic, it blocks dopamine, right? It's acting as a brake. So what is your brain going to do to try to maintain normal functioning? It's going to put down the accelerator, right? And researchers say today it's trying to maintain a homeostatic equilibrium. Okay? It's trying to maintain normal functioning. So you go on an antipsychotic, acts as a brake, the presynaptic neurons, at least for a period of time, now put out more dopamine than normal. And because they're putting out more dopamine than normal, now more is getting metabolized, and that's why for a period you will show elevated levels of metabolites in your cerebrospinal fluid. Okay? Now the second thing is that once researchers came to understand that, they said this. Maybe the problem isn't with the presynaptic release of dopamine, Maybe it's that there's too many dopamine receptors and that the brain is extra sensitive to dopamine. So at autopsy, they find a way, and I don't know how this is done, but they have a way to label the density of dopamine receptors. And they found at autopsy, people with schizophrenia have 50%, 70% too many dopamine receptors. So researchers say again, and this article appeared in Nature, a very prestigious journal, we have found the cause of schizophrenia. It's too many dopamine receptors. All right? But once again, the researchers said, we don't know if it's due to the drug or the disease. And what they eventually managed to learn to do in the 1980s, particularly in Europe, this research was done, was actually label living patients. Okay? And what they found is that prior to going on medication, they were not seeing abnormally high levels of dopamine receptors. But once you were on the drug, they did. And it was somewhere between 30% and 100% more receptors than normal. And you can read a paper, I think it's 1986, that says, our research shows this increase in dopamine receptors is entirely iatrogenic, meaning entirely drug-caused. And now this is an illustration that I took from a medical textbook without paying any copyright. Anyway, the point of this is now used as an illustration of how the drug responds to an antipsychotic. So what are you seeing here? You're seeing that the drug is blocking. You see those little white circles in the receptors? That's like the drug is blocking the receptors. And now, in order to try to maintain normal function, those postsynaptic receptors are increasing their density, their number. You see that? And this is often called now upregulation of receptors, okay? But I hope you see the mechanism here. Now, do you see a little bit of irony in this by any chance? Because schizophrenia was hypothesized to be due to too much dopamine. And by the way, one of the reasons, there was one other bit of information for that hypothesis, and that came from amphetamines. So amphetamines released dopamine, and it was well known that amphetamines could cause psychosis, induce psychosis. So that was another fact. But the irony here is this. They didn't find that, as a matter of course, people with schizophrenia or psychotic disorders have too much dopamine activity in the brain. But after going on the drug, you have the very problem or the abnormality hypothesized to cause the disorder in the first place. Now, of these two compensatory mechanisms, it seems like the extra release of dopamine burns out after a while. It doesn't stay. But these extra receptors do stay, and you'll see them at autopsy. Okay? So let's go to the other main theory of chemical imbalances, the low serotonin theory of depression. Okay, so what do those two classes of drugs do? They keep serotonin and norepinephrine in the synaptic cleft longer than normal, right? So they hypothesize that people with depression have low serotonin. And basically they do the same sort of research, okay? They look to see if the metabolite levels are different in depressed patients versus non-depressed patients, and they don't find that to be so. And then they did something really interesting in the U.S. in 1984. So they found that, as a matter of course, there wasn't this low serotonin as measured by metabolites in depressed patients. But they did know that certain patients seemed to respond better to antidepressants than others. It wasn't universal. So the NIMH in the early 1980s said this, maybe it's those people with low levels of metabolites in the cerebrospinal fluid on this bell curve of metabolite levels who are the best responders to antidepressants. So we're going to have a subgroup of depressed patients that do have low serotonin, and the drugs are going to fix that. So they ran a study in the early 1980s to test that hypothesis, and here's what they found. Yep, those metabolite levels fell along a bell curve. Some had lower, some had higher. But there was no correlation between metabolite levels and response to the drug. Those with high metabolite levels were just as likely to respond to the drug as those with low metabolite levels. So look what they conclude in 1984. You see this? I'll just let you read that. What you see here is the low serotonin theory of depression dying in 1984. Okay? Long time ago. So how does it get reborn? It gets reborn in 1987 when Eli Lilly brings Prozac to market. And especially in the United States where we have direct-to-consumer marketing, it really became a marketing story. Fix it, you know, it's like insulin for diabetes. It was a way, as a metaphor, for helping people understand, really to help sell the drug. Now, what's amazing to me is it just shows the power of American psychiatry and the power, in essence, of the drug companies in the United States to export that story, because it got exported basically worldwide at one point. But you see it's dying here. How about the next point here? Stephen Stahl is a person who believes in molecular psychiatry, so he's very much biologically oriented. So in 2000, he writes a book called Essential Psychopharmacology. It's a textbook used in psychiatry. And he says, there is no clear and convincing evidence that serotonin is a monoamine, okay? Monoamine deficiency accounts for depression. That is, there is no real monoamine deficit, all right? Now, the dopamine theory of schizophrenia, researchers are still researching this, actually. Is there something wrong with the dopamine system in certain subsets of people? There was a recent Swedish article saying, you know, maybe in this subset you see some problem, etc. But the classic hyperactive dopamine theory of schizophrenia fell by the wayside in the early 90s. They said it's no longer credible. And this person here, Stephen Hyman, he's the former director of the NIMH. So at one point he's our top psychiatrist. He's also a neuroscientist. You'll see what he wrote in 2002. There just is no compelling evidence that a lesion, do you understand a lesion in English? It means like a pathology in the dopamine system is a primary cause of schizophrenia. Next here is this, Kenneth Kendler. Who is Kenneth Kendler? Kenneth Kendler was recognized as one of the world's foremost experts on chemical imbalance theories of mental disorders. So in 2005, you'll see he wrote a paper about this, and what does he say? You can read it. He's saying, we looked for these chemical imbalances, but we did not find them. And in America, it's interesting, sometimes I do... You're going to have to forgive me on this, but we export things sometimes, and then sometimes it seems like sometimes in Europe, things fall apart faster in the United States. Well, I'm still hearing about chemical imbalance things in like Sweden, places like that. In the U.S., it's completely fallen apart. It's people are saying it's just wrong. I'm talking about the biological people, and here's my favorite quote of this. Ronald Pies is a former editor of the Psychiatric Times, which is the newsletter of the American Psychiatric Association. So here's what he wrote. You can see. It's always a kind of urban legend, never a theory seriously propounded by well-informed psychiatrists. In fact, if you read this whole letter, he says basically, blame Bob Whitaker for the chemical imbalance theory. In other words, he says, it was used by critics of psychiatry as a way to discredit psychiatry. Psychiatry knew it was false long, long time ago, but we pretend, critics pretend that psychiatry says this as a way to discredit psychiatry. Now, a couple years ago, I gave a grand rounds at Massachusetts General Hospital, which is a Harvard-affiliated hospital. It's the number one psychiatry-rated department in the United States. And the chemical imbalance, it was sort of a debate. And the chemical imbalance story came out, and a person named Andrew Nierenberg said this. That model was outdated in 1985, or 25 years ago. And he says, and yet you make it sound, with this sort of, sort of sneering thing, you make it sound like we still believe in this. So I said to him and all the residents, I said, you know, you're right. It was outdated 25 years ago, but I'm pretty sure you forgot to tell the American public. And everyone went like this. Because in the United States, 80% of Americans now know that low serotonin causes depression. And think about how powerful this metaphor is. The metaphor says, A, it's correcting something. B, it tells you you have a broken brain. And C, it tells you you have to take the drug forever, right? So it's really a powerful metaphor. I will tell you, in 1999, I was writing a series for the Boston Globe on abuses of psychiatric patients in research settings. At that time, I completely believed this story, that they fixed chemical imbalances. And one of the things we wrote about were studies in which they had withdrawn psychiatric medications from antipsychotic medications from schizophrenia patients. And we said those studies are unethical because you would never withdraw insulin from a diabetic, right? So why would you withdraw antipsychotic from a schizophrenia patient? That was the context, okay? By the way, I was very much rewarded for that series, which fit within this context of progress. But one of the things that started me on the pathway, the intellectual pathway that led me to here today was this. I asked someone named Jeffrey Lieberman, who's the outgoing president of the American Psychiatric Association. I'd gotten on the phone. He says, yeah, these drugs are like insulin for diabetes, blah, blah, blah. And I said, okay, that's great. Can you just point me to the studies that found this to be so? I just want to read those studies. Just do a little homework. And he said, well, we don't have those studies. So what do you mean you don't have these studies? I've been writing this for 10 years. And he said, well, it's just a metaphor. I said, what do you mean it's a metaphor? I didn't think I was writing metaphors. He says, it's a metaphor, and there's a little, you'll see this. It gets people to understand why they should take the drugs. Otherwise, they don't understand it. Seriously, that's what it was said. Because, quote, people with schizophrenia lack insight, they won't know why to take the drugs. So literally it was explained to me as a metaphor for why, in order to communicate with the public why they should take the drugs. But the minute I asked to see the data, I was told they didn't have it, which really shocked me, actually. Because I honestly did not know I was writing a metaphor. So then I called up the maker of Risperdal. Do you call it Risperdal? Okay. Because actually I couldn't quite believe this. So because now Risperdal was a newer drug and they're said to fix like five different neurotransmitters in the brain. I got the same thing. These are like insulin for diabetes. And I said, well, can you show me the studies? And the researcher from Janssen said, it's just a metaphor. Anyway, that's the story of chemical imbalances. So I think you see a couple things here. A, we didn't find it. B, the drugs induced the very changes hypothesized to cause the problems in the first place. And as we go through the long-term outcomes literature today, this is often also called oppositional tolerance, we're going to see if that worry pops up, okay, when they actually go over the long-term outcomes literature. But finally, let's just look at this paper by Stephen Hyman in 1996. You might want to see it just to assure yourself that what I'm talking about here is an accepted scientific understanding. Because he was director of the NIMH when he wrote this paper called The Paradigm for Understanding Psychotropic Drugs. You'll see the first part. They create perturbations in neurotransmitter function by, say, blocking receptors are blocking the reuptake process. That's the perturbation. Then he says the brain tries to adapt to that perturbation in order to maintain normal functioning. Okay? And it's always going to be the opposite. If the drug puts down the brake, the brain's going to try to put down the accelerator or vice versa. Okay? Now you see this causes substantial and long-lasting alterations in neural function. Okay, what's he really talking about here? He's talking about if you get changes in the density of receptors for, say, serotonin or dopamine, that means you're getting a change in...
That is the insights of Robert Whittaker, a top one of the world's greatest science writers, and who is head of the publications at Harvard Medical School. Now, let's just summarize what he has said. He has said that if you look carefully at all the actual studies, the best studies for the last 50 years, that these antipsychotic medications don't work, that it's all a theory, and that, oh, they knew it all along, it was a theory, that their diagnosing of schizophrenia, flawed, ADHD, ADD, flawed, bipolar, flawed, the treatment for depression, anxiety, flawed. What happens is that the chemicals that you're taking, the drugs you're taking, change your brain chemistry, and for the worse. So that is in one part. On other upcoming programs, I will share additional insights from Mr. Whitaker's research. Now let's go over to Duluth, Minnesota, where Dr. Gary Coles is retired family practitioner specializing in preventative mental health care for the last decade of his career. And he has expertise in the areas of traumatic stress disorders, brain malnutrition, non-pharmaceutical approaches to mental illness. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you, Gary. Thanks for inviting me.
I want you to respond to what is clearly almost revolutionary, historic. An absolutely mainstream scientist, not an alternative scientist, mainstream believing in drugs, doctors, medicine, CDC, and yet his research shows that the paradigm, the absolute foundation upon our entire mental health system, is grossly flawed. And so your assessment and review of the psychiatric profession today, which is becoming exceedingly more psychiatric drug-based and ignoring nutritional or psychoanalytic or behavioral therapy approaches, even in tandem. And after many years of seeing patients who come in with severe psychological conditions and on drug prescription regimens, what have been your observations on how the psychiatric profession treats patients and then how we are moving to a completely pill-based paradigm for treating mental disorders?
Yes, I never have believed what they've been telling us since my first exposure to mental ill health when I worked at a mental institution part-time delivering medical care to the psychiatric inmates. At that phase of my career, I really hadn't paid much attention. I rarely prescribed Prozac that was just on the market. I rarely prescribed any psychiatric medications. We didn't have a psychiatrist any closer than 30 miles away. I just couldn't bring myself to succumb to the advertising that was being promulgated about Prozac and then Zoloft and Paxil. So I had a chance to really thoroughly interview my patients there. It was not a very busy practice in the mental institution, so I had extra time, and I got background information from the very beginning of their so-called mental illnesses, and I discovered that they were all psychologically traumatized, oftentimes rape trauma, various psychological, spiritual, physical abuse, neglect, traumas, etc. And then they had all been on medications that had failed them. They didn't do any good at all or made them worse, and they were usually on multiple amounts of medications. Then when I started my practice, that was at the end of my family practice career, and when I started this independent practice of holistic mental health care, I was stimulated by the knowledge that what these patients had would qualify them for a post-traumatic stress disorder diagnosis, which has a known cause. It's traumatic stress. All the other 374 diagnoses in the DSM codebook have no known cause behind any of their diagnoses. And PTSD had a known cause. And that appealed to me because as a family physician, I was always taught to, you really want to look hard for the root cause, because if you know the root cause, then you have a chance of actually rationally treating it. And you also have a knowledge of how to prevent it in the next case. If you don't know the root cause of anything, you can't very well do any prevention. I saw that to be true in psychiatry. They did not know the root cause. They just had a checklist of symptoms, and then they came up with a diagnosis, which was usually false. It's pseudoscience, basically. Psychiatry is pseudoscience. So when I started my practice, I also had a chance to teach at the University of Minnesota here in Duluth in the psychology department. I was offered a chance to teach a holistic medical course. And so, having never taught before, I did a lot of research in the library there, looking way back in the original neuroscience research. They had a very extensive library, not as good as I had hoped, because a lot of the references I couldn't find in that library. But there were enough there to allow me to look at the basic neuroscience in the development of drugs like Prozac. And I discovered that all these SSRIs started out with an amphetamine molecule. They started out with speed, and then in order to patent a new drug, they would add a moiety here and there, a methane group or a hydroxyl group or whatever, other phenyl group. And then they would test it on rats, I discovered. And according to what the rat's response was, if the rat got sleepy, they'd say, well, maybe this is a sedative or an epilepsy drug. And if the rat got agitated, they'd say, well, maybe this is an antidepressant or something. And so that's how they did it. It was just a trial and error kind of thing in the development of these medications. And then when I looked further and found out how the FDA ever approved these drugs, discovered that they did about the same thing in the pharmaceutical industry's labs and research facilities. So, and then I studied what happens at the synapse. You know, that's where everything happens, is at the synapses. And so I looked at what these drugs and what the basic science was pretty accurate. They were doing unbiased basic science, the research chemists. And so I learned what happened with these medications at the synapse level with the receptor sites and the reuptake pumps and the various enzymes that are operating there. And the, so I'm not, you know, I don't claim to have perfect knowledge or expertise there, but I learned enough to know that these psychiatric medications mainly mess up the synapse. They mess up the reuptake pumps and they mess up the receptor sites. The antipsychotics inhibit the receptor sites, and that makes the nerves increase in number of receptor sites because they're being dumbed down, they're being blocked, they're numbed. And so the brain will respond by increasing the receptor sites there. So when the person goes off of the antipsychotic drug or cuts the dose down, all of a sudden there's a whole lot more receptor sites that are just ready to get activated. And so it doesn't take much nicotine or much caffeine or much dopamine like foods or drugs to make that person hyper responsive and act crazy.
Okay, Dr. Cole, we're running out of time, so I would like, if you would please, to give me just one-word answers.
Okay,
here's what we're going to do. I'm going to ask you a series of questions. We will have you back at another time to go into greater depth on those,
That'd be good.
Okay, do you believe that currently practiced psychiatry is a legitimate healing science?
No.
Do you believe that many of the mass murders, if not most of the mass murders, today are for people who are on the psychiatric medications?
Very true in the case of the school shooters. 90% of the ones we know about are intoxicated, brain intoxicated by the psych drugs.
Do you believe that the reason that we have a big push to screen all of Americans, especially children, for so-called mental disorders is because it would mean a larger market share for the pharmaceutical industry?
Absolutely, yes. It's a marketing technique, not doesn't have the health of the patient in mind at all.
Do you believe that the DMS-5, the Diagnostic Statistical Manual of Psychiatry 5, has any scientific legitimacy as a diagnostic manual?
No. And even the people who did the DSM-4, some of them agree with that statement.
Okay. Do you believe that the 23 American soldiers, current and past soldiers in conflict, who are killing themselves, would be killing themselves if they had psychotherapy or talk counseling rather than these antipsychotic medications?
Right. The antipsychotic and the antidepressants and the tranquilizers are causing sudden deaths as well as suicidal and homicidal tendencies.
Do you believe that we have not recognized the dangers of vaccines of not necessarily causing autism spectrum disorder, but in many people able to function, but interfering with brain chemistry to the degree that it can cause abnormal behavior?
Oh, yes. The ingredients in the vaccines, the mercury and the aluminum particularly, cause brain damage, actual brain damage, in that they disturb the mitochondria. They actually kill off mitochondria, which are the hearts and lungs of the cells of all the body, especially the brain. So the vaccines are very, very dangerous.
We're seeing an enormous amount of suicide in women between the ages of 25 and 45, which just so happens to be 25% of all American women between those ages are taking some form of psychiatric medication. Do you believe we would be seeing these women committing suicide or having suicidal ideation if they were not taking these medications?
No, and you're right. Psychotherapy is the way to go. And, of course, there's so much push to prescribe other drugs besides antipsychotics or antidepressants. And then they're usually pushing for vaccines which contain, especially the flu shots, which contain both mercury and aluminum, which are brain damaging.
Okay, for a number of years, there have been people such as Professor Fembauman and others who have stated that there is no legitimate science, none, supporting a brain chemical imbalance and using the antipsychotic or antidepressants to rebalance our brain chemistry. And yet the American media, the American science writers, the American Medical Association, and American science has refused to look for the evidence. Yes or no?
I agree with that statement. There's no evidence. I mean, there's over 100 different neurotransmitters in the brain, so how can there possibly be anything that balances them, especially a drug which actually messes up? And that actually causes depletions in some of the neurotransmitters. It's a totally bogus science.
Okay, when you examine people today, the number one cause of death in 10 to 14-year-old boys is suicide. Almost all those kids were in some form of antipsychotic or antidepressant medication. You have 10 million American children taking some form of psychiatric drug, and now you have over 300,000 infants, babies taking psychiatric medication. Do you believe this is an abrogation of moral responsibility to the patients by the physicians prescribing these medications to infants and children?
It's malpractice because there aren't any drugs that have been tested or approved by the FDA for that age group. So that's actually, they're being prescribed off-label, and so that's a form of malpractice.
But it's also a form of crimes against humanity.
Yeah, that's another way to put it. Right, yeah.
Right, because it goes against the Nuremberg rules.
Yeah.
Do you believe that any time in the near future the American public will ever be told the truth about the fraud of the psychiatric mental care approach to illnesses?
They are going to have to be forced to do it. There aren't that many of you and I and Robert Whitaker and Peter Gotchi out there, and most of us are blacklisted from the mainstream media, which is influenced by the pharmaceutical and big pharma and big psychiatry industries that are too big to fail, too big to criticize.
You can also look at some of the hosts on Pacifica's network, supposedly a liberal network, that has completely pro-vaccine, pro-big pharma, pro-psychiatric drugs approaches. So the idea that a liberal is somehow smarter, more humanistic, is just itself a fraud.
That's right. As long as they're influenced and their politicians are influenced by the big money that comes from those industries, we won't hear the truth or have proper legislation.
Well, we look forward to another discussion. We will be continuing this. This is only one part of an ongoing discussion. If you'd like some of the articles written by Dr. Gary Kohls, K-O-H-L-S, you can look at his articles on DuluthReader.com, and you can get those. Thank you very much for being with us today.
You're welcome. Please, I've tried to pay attention to the one I just wrote today about the school shooters, the making of sociopathic killers.
And we have posted that. We posted your article today on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. I'm Gary Nall. We're out of time for this Progressive Commentary Hour. Thank you all for listening. We look forward to sharing more on our next program. Have a nice day.